I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Pizzagate, QAnon, birtherism. Do any of these terms ring a bell? Whether you know these ideas or not, they're part of what our Dartmouth College professor guest today, Russell Muirhead, calls the new conspiracism. And by that he means not conspiracy theories in the sense you may be familiar with, but rather a new kind of conspiracy thinking that doesn't attempt to explain anything, just sow confusion and discord. Like this CBS News story on Pizzagate from December of 2016.
28-year-old Edgar Welch was arrested in Washington outside Comet Ping Pong, a popular family pizza parlor. D.C. police say Welch fired at least one round into the restaurant floor with an AR-15 rifle. No one was injured. Police say Welch drove all the way from North Carolina to self-investigate Pizzagate, a fictitious online conspiracy theory. Court documents say Welch read online that the Comet restaurant was harboring child sex slaves and he was armed to help rescue them.
Here's another one, a BBC Newsnight story on QAnon from last August.
President Donald J. Trump is fighting the deep state with all his might. He's helped in that battle by Q, a mystery U.S. government insider who leaves cryptic messages on the internet.
They believe that Donald Trump and his allies are basically the only people aware of this great evil going on in the world, and that great evil being that all of these Hollywood elites and so on are, among other things, running a pedophilia ring, eating the flesh of children, and basically responsible for all of the, I guess, evils or terrorist attacks we see in our lives.
And then there's this NBC News story featuring talk show host Alex Jones and his claims that the Sandy Hook school shootings were faked.
I don't know exactly what happened. Sandy Hook's inconclusive.
For years, Alex Jones was the most powerful voice behind a disturbing conspiracy theory that the Sandy Hook shooting was a massive hoax.
What do you do when they've got the kids going in circles in and out of the building with their hands up? I've watched the footage, and it looks like a drill.
And we'll pile it on. Here's a Fox News report from 2016 where then-candidate Donald Trump makes false claims that the father of Texas Senator Ted Cruz was linked to Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination.
Citing an article in the National Enquirer magazine, the Republican frontrunner brought a tabloid conspiracy story into the GOP race. The Enquirer indicated that they have pictures of a man who looks like Cruz's father, Raphael, albeit inconclusively, with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans, handing out leaflets for Fidel Castro in 1963.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being, you know, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this, right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that.
And there's been absolutely no information put forward that suggests that that is remotely true, but it's out there now. It hasn't been positively disproven, and it just sits as a question mark in the minds of those inclined to believe it. Russell Muirhead says that's a perfect example of the new conspiracism and the assault on democracy, which, not incidentally, is the subtitle of a new book he has co-written with Harvard professor Nancy Rosenblum. The book's full title is A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Russell Muirhead joins us now. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. And I'd love to have you go a little bit more deeply in your explanation of new conspiracism and conspiracy without the theory. What do you mean by that?
You know, it's the, like those two words, conspiracy and theory, almost always go together. It's hard to say one without the other. and that's because, for centuries, really, people have tried to make sense of the world, tried to make sense of the mysterious operations of power and make sense of events that are really hard to believe by conjecturing that there might be a conspiracy and gathering evidence and, like, investigative journalists or even scientists, social scientists, coming up with an explanation. And what Nancy and I noticed, we were really kind of bewildered and disoriented by a lot of the allegations being made in contemporary politics, and after sort of looking at them and studying them and thinking about them, we realized, yeah, this is conspiracy without the theory. It's not actually trying to explain anything in the world. It's actually making the world a lot more mysterious.
How is that different from just lying, or you know, now we have the term fake news, which is essentially just supposed to be something that's not true. Although, again, fake news itself, that phrase is disorienting and confusing and almost meaningless in many ways. But why is it conspiracism and not just lies?
You know, I think that they are actually part of the same package of what you could call misinformation, and they probably deserve to be treated together. Nancy and I think that conspiracism is especially potent because it has a kind of staying power. A piece of misinformation might last as long as a news cycle, as a piece of information might last, and then kind of disappear. These the new conspiracism, these conspiratorial allegations, stay around actually week after week, year after year. Take Pizzagate. I mean, it didn't go away. The gentleman who self-investigated with his assault rifle and declared there to be, in fact, no child sex trafficking ring going on, did not put the conspiracy to rest. It was revived, in fact, in QAnon, which your introduction also touched on. That Pizzagate is kind of part of the big QAnon concoction. The birther conspiracy is another good example. The idea that elites conspired, including foreign elites and maybe liberal elites, conspired to put someone in the White House who wasn't eligible to serve as president of the United States, Barack Obama, because he was allegedly born outside the country. It was even the production of his birth certificate wasn't sufficient to kill off this particular kind of misinformation. So I think it's not that it's fundamentally different. It's all part of the same picture as what we might call fake news or misinformation. But we think this is a particularly virulent part.
Does it matter, though, if most people don't believe either the old kind of conspiracy theories or the new conspiracism? I mean, is there something different now? Is there something different about having somebody in the White House, for example, who brings some of these up, even if he's saying, I don't know if it's true, but I heard this? I mean, is that a difference?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, to have a conspiracist move into the White House gives these theories, these allegations.
And you think he's a conspiracist. Donald Trump, you think, is a conspiracist.
I do. Yeah, I do. I think I sometimes refer to him as the, you know, conspiracist in chief. He has a conspiracist mindset. He gravitates to conspiratorial understandings and allegations almost instinctively with a kind of, you know, brio and panache that very few others have. I mean, he says that the election that elected him was a conspiracy. That's not the kind of thing you hear very often. Social scientists who study conspiracy theories have sometimes said that conspiratorial understandings are kind of the property of the losers or the outcasts in society and politics, people who stand far from the levers of power and feel, you know, often quite justifiably alienated. They gravitate, it said, to conspiratorial understandings in order to make sense of a kind of apparatus of power they can't control or see or understand. Well, it's really different to have the winners in politics, indeed the president of the United States, resort to conspiratorial understanding. So this is something new and we think, you know, particularly threatening even. But, you know, a great example is the guy wasn't in the office for more than 48 hours before he charged the Park Service with conspiring to doctor photographs and falsify the number of attendees at his inauguration.
Mark writes in to say the new conspiracism is essentially conspiracy theory for Luddites. People are divided right now and everyone thinks their side is right. Nobody wants to compromise or do the work involved in determining what's true. So it's easier to jump on a bandwagon that supports what you believe. This is another way for crude people with abhorrent beliefs to spread their vitriol and divisiveness under the guise of telling it like it is, while not accepting responsibility for the outcomes. Professor Muirhead, do you agree with that take?
I think there's something really astute in that observation. And it gets at part of the distinction between, let's call it kind of classic conspiracy theory and the new conspiracy without the theory. You know, the classic conspiracy theory often tried to make sense of real events. Take something like 9/11. It's hard to believe that 19 people without a lot of resources plotting in the sands of Afghanistan could successfully destroy the World Trade Centers and attack the Pentagon. The cause seems so small and the effect world historical. And because of that disproportion, I think people wonder, gosh, is that really the whole cause? And some people say, no, the cause is actually something bigger. The government was in on the planning. And that's the beginning of 9/11, the 9/11 conspiracy theory, which if you go to a website like 9/11, I think Architects and Engineers for Truth, you'll see lots of theories and lots of almost scientific explanations about the structure of the towers and so forth. It attempts to really persuade. It makes a claim to being true. The new stuff like Pizzagate, it doesn't explain – you know, no one heard anything. No one saw anything. There was an allegation of children being, you know, confined to the basement of this pizzeria. There was no basement. There's nothing in the world that's being explained. And so we might ask ourselves you know, our listener who wrote in, gosh, what is going on? And I think one of the things that's going on is something like Pizzagate functions to paint Hillary Clinton as the concentration of all that's evil. I mean, if you're really trafficking in children and enslaving them to provide sexual services, that's – does it get any worse? Are Nazis worse than that? She's just as bad as a Nazi in that picture. And what that does is it says to people, hey, if you happen to think that Hillary Clinton was the less desirable candidate, that on balance it was preferable to vote for someone else, well, you got it right. Not just kind of right, not just maybe right. You are 100% right. There is no doubt in this matter. And so it creates a political world where all goodness and all rightness is on one side, all evil on the other, and all ambiguities and all nuance is eradicated.
So there is a point, though. I mean, there is a point to spreading this misinformation, spreading this confusion. It's not just sort of like, you know, the Tower of Babel where everything is confusing. I mean, there is an aim, it sounds like, you believe, in having this information out there that makes people lose that nuance and hate the other side, whichever other side it is.
Yeah, that's right. It might have a kind of nice psychological function in eradicating ambiguity. You know, the political world, it is – the genuine political world is hard to understand, hard to find our way in, and it's hard to know sometimes. When I look at issues as a professor of political science, I get confused. I ask my economist friends, like, what should I think about trade? It's you know, they're complicated. Who's right here? And the more you look in, the more you find out that the truth is very rarely all on one side of a question. So it takes a lot of judgment, a lot of maturity to develop a political orientation and figure out, you know, who you should support or what you should be for. And yeah, I do think that the new conspiracy, it doesn't explain anything about the world. It makes it much more kind of magical and mysterious in a causal sense. But it does kind of, I think, by eradicating all ambiguity and uncertainty, it can kind of make people more confident about their own loyalties and identities.
Have you and Nancy Rosenblum sort of traced this all back to a start? I mean, do the people who first come up with a concept that they think, oh, you know what? I'm going to spread this and I know how to do it because we've got social media, we've got retweets, we've got ways to make this happen. Do they say, and here's why I'm going to do it, because I want people to hate Hillary Clinton or to hate Donald Trump? Or, you know, is there some belief? Is there some not validity in terms of fact, but validity in terms of, you know, what's in someone's heart to some of these?
You know, it's let's take as an example Alex Jones. Mm-hmm. He's one of the most notorious, well-known, what we might call conspiracy entrepreneurs out there. Nancy and I really don't purport to understand what is in his heart, what his real motivation is. We do notice that he makes a lot of money off peddling conspiracy. So we could attribute to him a very understandable interest in doing so. This is how he generates, or he used to generate, an audience for you know, his videos, for his show. He could then, you know, also sell nutritional supplements or attract advertisers. My guess is, if I were just going to guess, and it's you know, really, I don't have any expert. It's hard to get in another person's mind, probably impossible. I think he also probably at some level believes a lot of it. But you know, what happens with this really is it also functions to just displace the question of what's true. and replace it with a question of like, what do you want to be true, or what could be true, which is a much more plastic standard. And I'll give you an example, you know, of how this happened. So there's a member of Congress who said, "Hey, I think that you know, leftists and Democrats and liberals conspired to create a clash in Charlottesville between white nationalists and protesters." And he said, "I'm not telling you that this is true. I'm just saying it's plausible." And what that does is it invites us to stop asking whether it's true and put the question of truth right out of our minds, and instead step into a world where maybe whatever we want can be true. And that's what I think really might go on for someone like Alex Jones. He's no longer a person who cares about truth.
Let me ask you, you know, I sort of teased this before the break, this question of, are we just talking about right-wing extremism and right-wing conspiracies? Because that seems to be what many of the examples we've talked about are so far. But that's not, you know, that's not all of it.
Yeah, when Nancy and I went to great lengths when we were writing the book to try to answer this question for ourselves. And we really at some level didn't want to believe that, you know, most or all of this new conspiracism was coming from the right. But we did come to the conclusion that at least in this first wave, it really was coming from a kind of anti-governmental extreme, which we might characterize as right. We don't really see it as conservative because we see it as so corrosive to governmental decision making, governmental capacity, that it'll undermine the capacity of conservatives to do conservative things with government. And we do see it, though, as sort of anti-governmental in its thrust, at least in this initial wave. But, you know, the new conspiracism is very satisfying. It's satisfying to just remake the world, to impose your reality on other people. And we do expect that over time, if it's not contained, it's going to start coming from the left as well as the right. It'll start coming from all sides.
But you don't think it is now?
I think that at least up until maybe late 2018, it was coming predominantly from the right. I have been noticing, you know, more examples just in the last couple months of something like it coming from the left. I see certain accusations about the Federalist Society and courts that maybe are more allied with certain corners of the left. But so far, I do think it's really been more at home in the, let's say, the anti-governmental extremes of the right.
Let's go back to Bill in Randolph Center. Bill, hey, we got you now, I think. Go right ahead.
Once conspiracy theory, once it becomes you investigate it enough and you come up with the facts that prove the theory is okay, it's no longer a theory, it's a fact. And you mentioned 9/11. Well, there are 3,000 engineers, licensed architects and engineers, and the Building 7, it's a 47-story building, came straight down just like controlled demolition. So anybody that watches that would have to say, okay, we'll go along with the 9/11 conspiracy theory, but then once you dig a little bit, you'll find out that all the facts show that it was controlled demolition. And that,
what I appreciate about your comment is your concern for facts and for getting facts right. And listen, I'm not an expert on the particulars of that theory, which do get very, very specific. But what Nancy and I really do appreciate is that some conspiracy theories are true. Some are wrong. Some are mixes of what's right and what's wrong. And it takes some work to sort it all out. You know, there's a conspiracy theory that the committee to reelect President Nixon conspired to break into the Democratic Party headquarters to steal material and then to cover up the break-in. That does seem to have been true. There's a conspiracy that an event was faked called the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which provided the pretext for conferring great powers on President Johnson to pursue an escalation of the Vietnam War. That turned out to be true. So there are conspiracy theories that are true. And you're right. It takes work. It takes what you might call investigation or effort it takes a care for the truth to sort it all out. The new conspiracism really tries to just get the question of truth right out of mind, right out of the room, right out of the realm of politics.
Are you giving credence to what Bill says, though, where he says, if you look hard enough, you will discover that the facts say that 9/11 was not a terrorist plot. It was a controlled demolition. And we don't know exactly Bill's perspective on this, but a lot of the people say this was done by the government.
I know that. And I that's not my conviction about that particular event.
So when you say, though, you know, what you appreciate about Bill is that it does take these it does take investigation to figure out the truth. And in some cases, what the theory is, the sort of conspiracy, turns out to be true. And we have seen that time and again, not as many times as there are conspiracy theories, of course, but some things do turn out to be true. And so if you're a regular person sitting here listening, thinking, well, how the heck am I supposed to know what the truth is? And here you are, the co-author of a book about conspiracy theories, and even you're saying, you know, sometimes things end up to be true, and it's hard to find the information because none of us are there. None of us regular people are there, and we hear this theory and think, oh my gosh, well, maybe it's true. I don't know. Boy, I mean, now I'm starting to feel even more, A, confused, and B, scared.
Well, I mean, if you know, it would be, I guess, an easier world to navigate if it were the case that any time there was a conspiratorial accusation, it was false. You know, if I could tell you, anytime you hear someone charge something with a conspiracy, you know they're wrong. You know they're crazy or something like that. But I just don't think that's the case. You know, one of the things that Nancy and I noticed is that the Declaration of Independence itself is a conspiracy theory. It accuses Great Britain with conspiring to undertake a whole series, a long train of actions, all tending in the same direction, which is to extinguish liberty in the colonies. And, you know, actually, even now, as historians, it takes a lot of work to sort out whether their charge of conspiracy was true. So yeah, the understanding of the world is you know, difficult. What I really do appreciate in the caller is this care for truth. And it may be the case that ultimately it's really hard to navigate without putting a certain amount of trust in certain kinds of knowledge-producing institutions, such as the free press, such as the university, maybe even the court system when it comes to determining something like guilt or innocence, and that we can't, in fact, each of us alone, always investigate every single charge fully and completely. There's not enough time in the day for that. So it may be the case that from day to day, to make sense of the world, we have to trust certain knowledge-producing institutions. And I'll tell you, one of the things we worry about in the new conspiracy, the conspiracy without the theory, is that among the institutions it really targets are knowledge-producing institutions. Mm-hmm. It goes after, you know, these lonely government agencies filled with, you know, I don't know, experts, PhDs, topic experts who are really just trying to excavate elemental facts. Agencies like the National Weather Service or the Bureau of Labor Statistics that tries to come up with the unemployment rate. You know, Trump, when he was running, said the Bureau of Labor Statistics was conspiring to fake the unemployment rate in order to make Obama look good. He said the real unemployment rate is like 40%, not, you know, 4%. And what that does is it causes people to lose their confidence in all of these institutions that provide us with the kind of – not the theories but just the elemental facts that are necessary – in order to make sense of the world and make good decisions in the world.
We certainly have seen an assault on, you know, what you mentioned, the free press, which is there in theory to try to seek the truth, to find out what's actually happening in the halls of power. We got a note from Brandon on Facebook who says, I'm not a supporter of the controlled dissent operation that is QAnon. Will you also, though, talk about how the CIA infiltrated mainstream media and the media's propagandizing also distorts and degrades our democracy?
You know, one of the interesting distinctions between between conspiracy and let's say bias. I have friends who say, "Hey, the university today is biased because it's filled with liberals. There are very few conservatives in it," and for that reason, I'm really skeptical of at least certain kinds of, you know, findings that come out of maybe social science, like your field, Russ. They might say, and I think actually it's really. It's really right to be skeptical to be skeptical citizens, to be skeptical about powerful institutions, and especially to be skeptical when we think those institutions might be biased. A charge of bias is one thing. It's almost like there's kind of an unconscious tilt to the kinds of questions that are being asked, the kinds of data that's being adduced, the kinds of conclusions that are being embraced. That's different from saying people are intentionally conspiring to systematically deceive or betray the interests of the people. And so, you know, right, maybe we do need to be skeptical of certain kinds of – maybe certain institutions in the media or certain knowledge-producing institutions like certain corners in the university. Skepticism is one thing. Conspiracy is another.
I like that distinction and just want to highlight it, elevate it, that difference between conspiracism and bias, and an interesting one for us to tease out because all of these words just sort of get thrown out there sometimes in these conversations.
Yeah, you're right, Jane. Yeah.
Let's go to Frank in Montreal. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. My concern with the conspiracy theories and theorists that I see on social media today are anti-science, not just the anti-vaxxers, which is a whole problem in itself, but specifically flat earthers, moon landing hoaxers. Sometimes it's religiously motivated. Sometimes it's motivated by a simple mistrust in the government. And so my problem with some of these people is that instead of focusing on aspects and areas of the government that are indeed trying to deceive you about various things to keep themselves in power or to keep the status quo, instead of focusing on that, they're picking on agencies like NASA and focusing on completely outlandish conspiracy theories that cannot possibly be true. And they're not interested in reason or debate. I think it's just a question of severe misplace of that trust. And it frustrates me that instead of focusing on elements of the government that are indeed trying to deceive you, they're picking on elements that are actually just trying to educate the public. It's extremely frustrating.
Yeah, Frank, thanks for that. And Russell Muirhead, I mean, that's an interesting direction to go with sort of anti-science conspiracies. And Frank mentioned anti-vaxxers or vaccine hesitancy. You know, there's also a lot of questions about who's controlling the conversation about GMOs, about climate change. I mean, there are a lot of science and anti-science conversations going on.
And I really I hear the frustration in Frank's voice. And I just want to say that kind of emotional reaction is really what motivated Nancy Rosenblum and I to take up the subject and to pursue it as long as we did. We share that alarm, and we don't think that this is, just a kind of entertaining thing from the fringe. We think that this could be really pretty corrosive to the practice of democracy. So I'm with you, Frank. I share that. And, you know, just to kind of go back to the point, Jane, that we were just talking about between bias and conspiracy, you know, let's say you think that some sort of corner of the scientific community is biased. The purpose of bringing that charge, you know, say, hey, you scientists, whatever, you atmospheric scientists, you're being biased in some way. The point is not to destroy science, but to get to a science that isn't marred by bias. So the, you know, when you criticize a media institution, a newspaper, a website for being biased, the point is to get to a more impartial, more unbiased media. It's out of a belief in the possibility of good media, good journalism, that the charge is made. And I think Frank is right on that the new conspiracism is not trying to, you know, cleanse the world of corruption or bias in order to get to a better politics that serves people more effectively. It's doing a lot of destruction, including, you know, you might say, as he does, the destruction of science.
Let's go to David, who's with us from St. Albans. David, where do you come in on this conversation?
My question was, in today's political climate, how do you frame an argument when there's no longer any societal agreement or compact on what even constitute facts? Author mentioned, you know, the Sandy Hook conspirator that denies that it even happened. Well, you know, that's the most grotesque extreme example of conspiracy when you have, you know, 20 dead children that, you know, their parents are in grief struck and you're denied. But, you know, when the president, for instance, you know, says something dozens of times. It's been filmed on, you know, tape, caught by all the media, conservative and liberal. And then weeks later or months later or years later, we'll say, I never said that, or I meant something different. And he'll say, you know, about the wall or whatever, you know, that's, you know, we're going to build a wall, make Mexico pay for it, and then, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I never said that.
David, let me pick it up. So, yeah, I mean, this question about, we don't even necessarily in our society today have a shared agreement on what truth is.
Yeah, and what the million-dollar question that I hear him asking is, how do we have an argument? And Nancy and I ask the same question. We believe in argument. We believe in you know, vigorous disagreement in politics. And we're scholars of parties and politics before we came to this subject. And you're right. In order to have a good argument, you have to have a kind of substrate, and you have to have some ingredients to argue with. And those ingredients are, in the first instance, facts. You know, if we obliterate facts, if we make all facticity just a matter of partisan identity or loyalty, if we you know, distort reality to such an extent that we lose touch with common sense, our ability, it's not, you know, our ability to argue will disappear.
If we could just shut off the internet or, you know, get rid of social media, would we solve the problem? I mean, isn't so much of this the echo chamber of tweets and retweets and sharing and social media arguments that have no actual, you know, real world anchoring?
Right. Repetition is being substituted for, you know, validation. But, you know, this is kind of a Gutenberg moment. We massive revolution in communication technology. Anybody can say anything to everybody, to all 7 billion people in the world, the gatekeepers, the producers, the editors that used to decide what was worthy of being broadcast. They are not there anymore. And our, you know, democratic politics is going to have to – we're going to have to figure out how to keep our democracy with this new revolution in communications technology.
Russ, you haven't made me feel better, but I suppose you've given me a lot to think about, and I thank you for that.
Well, gosh, I thank you for inviting me to join you. I really appreciate it.
Russell Muirhead is a political science professor at Dartmouth College. He and Harvard professor Nancy Rosenblum are the authors of a new book. It's called A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy.